he had done so much meth between the changeovers that he like OD'd. I don't tell. That's why he was so fast. He completely OD'd on meth in the porta potty. You know, and I'm like carrying my drums like around him. Like, I can't believe this is happening. Like, you know, this. I'm like, you were the chosen one.
Dude, I'm way too high to answer that question.
It's not my job. I was working under Jason Burney, so it's Jason's job to be like, piss off, buggers, no set list. You know, it's not my job. I'm just like smiling drummer guy with the floral shirts.
And these two big security guards are right there, and they see me, this little fucking weird white boy with tattoos, running like, oh my god, and they like. They got right in front of Morris, and they're like, the fuck is this guy about to do?
Hey, this is Party Like a Rockstar podcast, and I'm your host, Joel. Today's episode is brought to you by Misha's Kind Foods. They're an LA-based small business making the world's finest non-dairy cheese on the market today. They're lactose-free, paleo, keto, kosher, perev, and 100% vegan. If you like what you see, check out the next video. If you like this video, please subscribe and like by clicking the little round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or our other guests on the show, go to joelrody.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle is Joel Rody. If you haven't already read my book, Memoir of a Rody, it's now available through Amazon and paperback, Kindle, or as an audiobook. I hope you enjoy the show. All right, I'm going to intro you guys. We'll get going.
All right, here we go.
Taylor Roberts is the lead vocalist and guitarist for the band Nine Inch Nails. He recently recorded the track Every Day is Exactly the Same. Check it out. It's on Spotify.
Yeah.
The second guest is Sean Benton Doria, a.k.a. Thunder. He spells the word, his name Thunder wrong, but that's because he's a roadie. A very talented road dog. He's worked as a stage manager and drum tech for Devil Driver. He's worked as a drum keyboard tech for King Crimson. Those aren't jokes, by the way. That stuff's true. He's played drums for Traded Moments, Color Under Fire, Born Astray, and the kick-ass band Riding With Killers. My first question is to you, Taylor. And my question is, I hear that you're looking for a new drummer. Is that true?
Yeah. Well, so when I first started this thing out, I'm from the Gulf Coast, same area as Sean. But my first real tour in 2013, we got to go out on the road with Taproot. And that was my original band that I started when I was like 15, but that was called Catharsis. And Dave and I just got to become really good friends on the road. And when I left my previous band, I ended up moving up to Detroit, and we started writing a record. And you know, with where I'm wanting to go and where I'm at, like, we, Dave and I kind of got to a point of where it's like, all right, it's time to hand off the torch. Like, we still play Call of Duty together every single night and talk every single day. Dude's my brother and his family's my family, but just got to a point of where it's like, you know, schedules were starting to conflict because he's a touring drummer. Like, he's out with Sponge right now. I think he's out with playing with Marcy Playground tonight.
Killer drummer.
Yeah, I do love Marcy Playground. So, you know what I mean? It just got to a point of where, like, Dave, he believed in the project, but Sean is
not your drummer, because I was just fucking around.
Oh, yeah. I was giving you backstory.
No, I know. I like it, but Sean. I was like, well, shit, I was right.
That's why. I laughed. I was like, that he has no idea.
I had no idea.
I was like, he has no idea. He asked the real question.
It was right. See, I'm all proud of myself now. Yeah, so research.
There was kind of this like change of like a handing of the torch. Like, I guess it just was one of those things where like Taylor and Dave both were like, this guy Sean could definitely do the job. So, you know, it's definitely honorable that Dave wants me to do the thing. But yeah, it's weird, but it's lovely, because that's how music is, you know. It's like this melting pot, you know.
So what's Dave going on to do? Are we supposed to say or no?
I mean, he's basically on the road with Sponge a lot these days. He owns his own business, and you know, he's doing the thing, and he's doing session work for a friend of mine, Audrey. She's a country singer up here, wonderful artist, and I've been up on a couple of sessions with them hanging out. So Dave is just, he's always on the go. And basically he believed in what I was doing, and he wanted to help me get this project off the ground to where I could find someone like Sean, where it was the perfect match for what I do and where I want this band to go. So basically Dave was there to help me kickstart stuff so I could find Sean, essentially, you know. That's basically kind of how it went.
Oh, we love Dave. What was it? Up in Smoke? Where's Dave, man? Where's Dave, man?
You're not.
Oh, wow, man. That's the most acid I've ever seen with one person take at a time. Wow.
Seen this movie, huh? All right. So how did you guys meet each other? Was it through Dave, or you know each other already?
It was outside of a venue in Slidell, Louisiana. My old band Catharsis was playing, and Sean and I just started talking, I think, randomly outside.
I was the front of house guy at Corner Pub. So like, yes. Slidell is very small. It's like between New Orleans and Biloxi, and it's interstate town. A lot of history there. We can cover that later. Either way, Slidell's music scene is kind of like non-existent. So if you play drums, you probably do front of house, and you probably do lights for somebody on the weekend, you know, and everybody knows all 10 musicians. So, you know, one way or another, I was mixing at the only club booking bands with two guitar players and a drummer, like, you know, like very not happening. Most of the scene is like cover bands, which is awesome. And I've done it myself, but you know, original rock bands coming in, you kind of have to do more than just put 57s on everything and thumbs up at the stage. Like, you know, so
not much
you know,
more, by the way, not much more.
Yeah. You know, and not much more. But you can't just go to the bathroom, you know, but so Taylor's band was playing. I'd known those guys a lot. Anyway, locally, we had a lot of mutuals, and this is like early Facebook. So we're all seeing each other before the algorithm hit us from each other. And so I'm seeing Taylor gigging a lot. I'm like, damn, this motherfucker has a goddamn piano rig in his band. I hope this band doesn't come to my club. And then a month later, I'm like, oh, he's in my club. But it was tight, you know. Sawyer's badass, great keyboard player. So I end up hanging out with two of them. And me and Taylor just kind of had this vibe, you know. It's drummer, guitar player. And it's that great energy that goes, you know, in history. Like Bill Bruford, Robert Fripp, no pun intended. And then, you know, James Hetfield and Lars Ulrich, like, there's this energy, like, you know, Mario Duplantier and his brother, you know, like in Gojira, like there's this guitar player drummer pair, the Bonham, you know,
the Vanilli with thing. The Vanilli.
Yeah, that's two.
No pantomime.
You know, yeah, I have the hair. I have Milli hair. But yeah, me and Taylor had a vibe, and I could definitely tell there was a friendship brewing there. And we'd always stayed cool, you know. Me and him are both very stubborn, very, very headstrong, very I got to do it this way kind of vibe. So for us to have never, you know, interacted negatively, it was like, okay, there's definitely like a positivity here. There's a partnership there.
That's better than all those other guys you mentioned.
Oh my God.
I fight all the fucking time.
Cool, man. Cause like we, you know, like that initial first conversation that Sean and I had, like I just remember I was like, I like this guy. I really, really like this guy. And like, you know, I was like, no, let's sit here and keep a conversation going. And then we just kept running into each other over the years. And I remember, because I'm stupid, like I totally didn't. He ran into me backstage randomly. We were playing with All That Remains.
Was it All That Remains or was it Trivium? Or was it also All That Remains? Did you play?
We did Trivium and All That Remains at the same club.
I'm friends with Woody. Woody is Black Dahlia Murder's front of house, right? I love Woody. Great. Watch all the DVDs. Rest in peace, you know, Trevor Sternad. But Woody's in all the DVDs. He is Trivium's current front of house.
Okay.
But he was Trivium monitors at that very moment. And me and my friend William, who worked for Devil Driver, we showed up to hang out with Trivium boys. And I was like, that's Taylor Roberts again with that fucking piano rig.
Yeah.
Aaron Moeller was flying.
What the fuck are you doing here, man?
Yeah. I saw Moeller first. Chill with Moeller real hard. And then I was like, there's that Taylor Roberts guy with the Batman guitar. And then I blew his mind. With, yeah, you tell him the guitar.
And this is funny because like I ordered this guitar custom. It was when I was still endorsed with Aristides Guitars, a wonderful guitar company over in the Netherlands. Amazing stuff for me when I was with them. I recently joined with Gibson, but back to the Aristides boys. I had custom ordered Lumen Lay inlays and I had no fucking idea how to use them because I'm stupid. And I was just talking to Sean about it. He was like, bro, hold on real fast. He takes his phone flashlight out and he puts it there and like my entire fretboard lights up. And I was like, what the fuck? And he's like, welcome to the world, boy. And like just another beautiful, fun interaction with Sean. And like, I don't know, man, just every time we've hung out or been around each other, we feed off of each other. There's a good energy there. And then
definitely
beautiful love story.
If you saw CPR footage, you know that as well. There's a lot, you know, we had never played together and that vibe was already there. I mean, I kept running into Taylor as young guy who I think is cool, who's playing. And I'm recently off a tour from teching, kind of feeling that roadie depression a little bit when you're like a player. And, you know, like I love drum teching, but you know, at the end of the day, I only play the kit for 25 minutes. He plays the kit for, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours. So, you know, I'm getting what, like 110 hours a kit a year teching, and this guy's getting like hundreds a week. So it adds up on you when you went to school for music and you session drum at home. It's, you know, without the ego or not, you just miss drumming. So
where school are you going?
I went to Mississippi Gulf Coast Community College. I'm a community college boy, but I'm also
MGCCC, baby.
Exactly, bro. It's not about chops. It's where you put your parts. And I say that all day long. You know, community college might not have chops like Berklee College of Music, but you know, I was kind of hoping
you said Berklee College of Music. So.
No,
I was going to change the subject.
I wish I said Berklee College of Music too. No, it's all good, man. That would be a different story, but you know, my last name would end up being Bruner or Thundercat or something. You know, it'd be way cooler.
It'd be cooler. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, it's always been that vibe.
All right, so I did listen to your music, even though I made fun of you with Nine Inch Nails there. But one of the songs you did is you did a song I heard with Paul McCoy from 12 Stones.
Yes, World Apart.
Killer, bro.
Thank you. Thank you very much, man.
So how did you link up with him? Or did he write it and send it to you? You wrote it and sent it to him? Or how did all this go down?
Paul and I have been friends for years. And like I remember being like 14, 15 years old, going to Bebop Records, Potter's Field had just come out, like 12 Stone signed my guitar, and then I kept running into him. And then just as I got older and started playing bigger shows and getting involved with the radio station, 97.9 WCPR in Gulfport, Mississippi, they've been so wonderful to me since I was like 15, 16 years old, man. Like they've given me a lot of great opportunities, but just through networking there, you know, Paul and I got to know each other. Then we started playing shows together and I don't know, man, like we formed a really cool friendship, and he's just as stupid as I am. And I say that with love, but like, he's just one of those dudes that I can be a complete idiot around and we feed off of it. And it just turns into one big stupid giant ball of idiocy, but like I love it. And
that's how the song was written. That'd be a good, how did you write the song? We're both idiots. Oh, it sounds like that.
Yeah, basically. So but we had started writing this song, and I was never the vocalist in Cather Sister or Wildfire, and I was always just the guitar player. So this was kind of like in my earlier stages of songwriting, I didn't really know how to put a chorus to what we had, but like, we didn't really want to change it too much because we really liked the drive of the song. And I hit up Paul and I was like, yo, like,
when you say we, this I know is we've been trying to make this happen. Dave?
What's that?
When you say we, it's you and this guy, Dave.
Yeah. And Tim Krukowski from the band Sponge recorded the bass, and he did some writing with us on a lot of those tunes as well. So basically, I just hit up Paul and I was like, hey man, like I have a song, I need a chorus, let's work together on this. And the first thing that he came back with, I was like, this is beautiful, it works. it's a fucking mouthful, because like singing that shit live and playing guitar, like I remember the first time I played it live, I went fuck you Paul right under my breath, because I was like, oh, I gotta come up
that's wild
rapid fire vocals. But you know, it was cool, man.
Good. Yeah, right on. So one of the questions I do like to ask us is some of the funnier gigs you guys have had. Both of you guys have gigged a lot. So do you have any venues or gigs that you can think of that come to mind that are just funny?
Yeah, man. You want me to go first, Taylor, or you got one?
Yeah, right? You go first.
Okay, all right. So, I mean, there's a lot, man. I've been a touring tech since like 2014. So let's see. What's a really good one? Okay, this one's about, yeah, okay. So I'm doing Warped Tour 2016. I'm working for a Japanese band called Cold Rain. Load-ins at Warped Tour are wild. It's really steamy. The grass is super hot. Your bus shows up early if you have a good driver. We had Quentin, so we were always early, bro. I always knew where catering was. Quentin's the man. Anyway, I'm loading my stage. You know, all the backline has to be put in a row outside. You build your stuff. And then when it's your turn, you go early up on the riser, and then somebody's on the riser. So you have your gear, like my drum set, staring at Chelsea Grin's drum set being played on. The minute Chelsea Grin's done, the hands take it off the stage, mine goes on, and the chain happens. That chain is miserable sometimes because you got all these homies and they got their water and they're smoking weed all near my fucking drum set, like it's on the side of the stage. So I hate it, right? So
none of those guys ever have a drum key ready either.
Yeah, I mean, no,
it's fucking worthless.
It depends. I've met some weapons out there. I was a stagehand. I was a Rhino stagehand. I always have my drum key. So like I said, community college Rhino, but what's
up? Where you're going places.
But what's up, you know?
Yeah.
It's not remedial. It's local. It's different. Anyway, back to the story. So I had this super hand, bro. He is the man. He like knows how to put the cymbal stance correct. He respects the memory lock. He's like, yo, hell, he's like telling the other hands, how we're going to bring the kid up there. Amazing, bro. We go to do my changeover. He's nowhere to be found. This guy had the plan and everything. So I put my kid up, not a big deal. It's a 4-piece kit, China cymbal, double pedal, whatever. But I'm like, oh man, where's my man? You know, I was going to set some waters, do some more stage manager stuff, but now I've allocated the time the other direction. So now I'm kind of behind myself if the guy never would have helped me. Set ends. I still never see him ever. And I've been noticing that there's been a super long line at the porta potty, like since my changeover. So I have no idea. Like, okay, well, I got to pee. I'm just thinking as a roadie, like when I'm done with this kit, I'm pissing behind it because there's a long line. And now I finally see security like knocking on it. I'm like walking a kick drum down. Security's like knocking on the porta potty. Dude, they open it, bro. And he just falls face first out unconscious, bro. He had done so much meth between the changeovers. And he like OD'd. I'm telling, that's why he was so fast. He completely OD'd on meth in the porta potty. You know, and I'm like carrying my drums like around him. Like, I can't believe this is happening. Like, you know, this. I'm like, you were the chosen one.
I love you, man.
You know, so. That's like my craziest story. There's funnier ones, but that one's like the notable tour. Like my roadie disappeared and got really loaded.
Why go to the porta potty though? I guess that fucked up. What do you know?
It was because he cared about the gig. He wanted to be close. He was probably trying to listen for when changeover was happening. Cause you know, there's that big silence. Like it's band and it's silence. And you're like, oh, that's changeover. You know,
I can
like
figure that out, not being in the porta potty.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. More power to him though. That brother was a champion. I hope if you're watching, I hope you're out there. Keep stage handing.
Sure, he's doing great.
All right, what you got, Taylor?
All right. So I cannot remember the name of this venue. I do know it was Bowling Green, Kentucky, while we were on tour. And I remember we pulled up to the venue and I see like a bunch of crosses and shit everywhere. And I'm like, I mean, whatever, but like, not like cool crosses, but like churchly, like
yeah.
godly crosses. And I was like, guys, where are we? And it turned out we were playing a church/bar. It was the weirdest thing I've ever done in my entire life. And we played on a stage that had a podium to the right where people gave sermons. And I just remember my vibes were totally off that day. And like, you know, one of those shows where you're playing and you're like, dude, this sucks. Like, this is not a good show. The sound is balls. Like, there's no room to like have fun. And like, just the air is weird. Well, I remember that I kept looking into the crowd and I saw the silhouette and I'm like, dude, that's our fucking manager. I bet it's our manager. Cause like he hadn't been out on that tour. And I'm like, and I remember I forget who I said something. I was like, bro, I'm pretty sure that's Eric. And our manager at the time was Eric Baker. I fucking love that guy. And they were like, no, there's no way that that's him. And like in my mind, I'm like, that's fucking him. And after the set, like I walked off stage and he walks right up to me and I can see his face. And I'm like, fuck, that's him. And his first words out of his mouth were, that fucking sucked, dude. What was that? And I was like, damn. But yeah, so like we totally sucked at the church bar.
You should have used like the preacher thing. What do you call it, like a vestibule? You should have used that as your ego riser.
I would have had to done like a fucking box jump, like 6 feet in the air just to land on top of that bitch. But other than that, another good one.
But wait,
it was the last night that Grand Central Station was opened in Mobile, Alabama. We played the last show, and I remember this dude walked in a dope-ass suit and, like, caught my attention. And I was, like, and I was headbanging. I kept looking at him, and, like, he was smiling, taking photos and shit. And I was, like, is that the motherfucker from P.S. I Love You? And I was, like, no.
The movie P.S. I Love You?
Yeah, it sucks that that was the first. It's a good-ass movie. Fuck you. but like I hate that was like the first movie that came into my head that I thought of. It wasn't like The Watchmen or, you know, some shit like that, but like Jeffrey Dean Morgan was totally just randomly at our show.
Oh, and that's amazing. Jeffrey Dean Morgan.
Yeah. Oh. So like it was the dude from P.S. I Love You and The Walking Dead and
he's the comedian from Watchmen, dude.
Yes, yes. Also, that's what I'm saying. I was really sad that's not where my mind went first. It went to PSO.
He's supposed to be Thomas. He's Thomas Wayne Batman in Flashpoint.
Yep.
Yeah.
Very reminiscent of that.
He's the Batman that kills people. He's like, you kill, because in that universe, Thomas Wayne's son, Bruce Wayne, dies, and Thomas Wayne becomes
Batman. And Martha
becomes
the Joker.
Yeah, Martha becomes the Joker. Yeah, the killing joke, right?
Or, no, we're nerds, dude.
Yeah, it's a lot. Yeah, we like it. You got to like it. Our thing is comic books in the span anyway. That's the new direction anyway. It's gonna be great. The graphic novel is gonna be awesome. It's gonna be some cool stuff.
You're doing a graphic novel?
Yeah, we're gonna make an attempt. I used to play test card games with this company that made the Dragon Ball Z card game. A bunch of friends of mine from this town have been play testers, and so I've been playing like Warhammer, Magic the Gathering, Dragon Ball Z, competitive tabletop. I was like going to different cities and states and tournaments, like winning Pokemon tournaments as a kid. So tabletop card gaming is like my thing, you know, other than, you know, and I've always loved comic books. I was telling Taylor, you know, he had a Batman guitar at one time, and I was like, dude, we should absolutely, you know, incorporate this love of, you know, animated illustration and try to back some of the message Taylor has to preach in his music. And, you know, yeah, it kind of works out, you know, pushing an energy, pushing an art form vocally and in motion, I think is awesome. Cirque du Soleil. Okay, I can sum it all up. Blue Man Group, Cirque du Soleil. It's more than watching. You're like, you're going home and you're pondering. Like, you can do that in a band, man. Like, I've seen Ice Nine Kills make kids go home and go, is he really a serial killer? You got him. Now you're the poster, Spencer, because the kid thinks you're like, it's cool. You've broken the wall of being a person. You're an avatar now. You know, it's, I love that. Slipknot. All
graphic novels a shitload of work, though.
Yeah, it is, but Fiverr exists, and I write a lot, man. I can't tell you how much I write.
I was doing one. I was doing one with Daniel Johnston, and he started working on it, which is really neat, but I never saw any of the drawings. After he died, I wrote to his brother, because his brother was his manager, asking if he has him still, but I never saw him. But that would have been super cool. And then I asked Slash, because Slash is a killer artist. Killer.
Yeah, for sure.
And he's like,
some of that stuff Saul has done is crazy, man.
So you want me to do a whole fucking book, man?
I think it's gonna
be easy thinking, I'm like, because I'm gonna make him do it.
Yeah. In today's technology, like the idea of a graphic novel living on the internet or being a digital version. I mean, a lot of it is motion. I mean, I don't know if you ever played the game Sly Cooper, but that game is a still motion comic book. And a lot of it's narration, man. Like, you know, it's all about me, Taylor, and James actually doing the voice acting of your character. Like it's yeah. of ourselves, you know, it's not this fake thing. It's like a layover of what really happened. The story of Taylor finding me and like, you know, and James being in and out of all these, it's like, you know, it's like this, how old is James? I have no idea.
And
know,
James is Dracula.
Yeah, I mean, he's a vampire. From Romania. So. And it's, you know, and in the book, I'm a werewolf. I've always convinced myself the werewolves. And you know, this
it's good. You're not making it confusing. That's good.
No, of course not. It's very simple. It's
have you done the first page yet?
Oh no, no drawings at all, because I'm trying to let it formulate. I'm just writing the story, because every great narrative has to have plot. It has to have natural
storyboarding right now.
Star Wars was a napkin before it was a trilogy, before it was a five piece. It was a fucking napkin. So that's, you know, that's where I let everything lie. The best lyrics ever, you know. Hotel California was a fluke of a live recording. That's not even the one they sent, you know? So,
yeah.
So, man, graphic novel, taking the art to the next step. Big nods to Coheed and Cambria, big nods to Slipknot, big nods to In This Moment for taking that and avataring, you know, and you know, making a monster, being a hero. That's great. I love comics. He loves comics. That's it. That's
the James is big into comics too. And, you know, that was our thing. Like, I used to draw comic book characters. I mean, I collect them, and I've got a Batman tattoo, Joker right there. Like, it was just something that, like, when I was growing up, what's that?
Yeah.
I mean, it was one of those things. That's what my mom raised me on. It was like Star Wars, Indiana Jones, the 89 Batman. And then, like, when I was a kid, you know, because my mom was a single mom, like, I was at my grandparents' house a lot, or like watching TV and stuff. And like the animated Batman series was just one of those escapes for me. And I would get so lost in the stories, and rewatching those now as an adult, like, those were pretty damn dark and good stories for like a kid's show. And like, for something that was such a big part of my life growing up. And now that, with this band, there's a vehicle to do something like that. Like, it's really cool for me, because it's like 14-year-old me is stoked at all the ideas and the things that are happening. And that's, you know, I want to make that kid happy, you know. And I feel like this is one of those ways to, you know, for all of us in the band to express who we are through a different art form, but it's also contributing to the music. And that's what's so fun about the band name, is that whenever I came up with it, it was like, man, this is a name that I can have fun with muscle cars or classic cars or movie villains or serial killers or
what,
you know, there's
killer?
Just so
what
many different killer? Things so... and now the comic, you know.
Yeah,
it's just, there's so many possibilities and ideas for all of us to really be creative and dig down deep aside from just the music aspect of it.
I remember I was at a party, got a big argument with the guy, because he was saying how Jared Leto was the best Joker. I'm like, Jared Leto, really? That's the guy?
I don't know.
And I'm like, what about Cesar Romero? And he's like, oh.
Mark Hamill.
Mark Hamill?
Mark Hamill awesome. Is the Joker. Like, that's, I don't care who you look at, that's the voice you hear. So,
yeah.
And that's narrative. I don't know, man. But
Kevin Conroy, that's.
I mean, dude, Heath lost his life over it. How could you not put him in the count? But at the same time, Jack Nicholson, like, what are you? We shouldn't argue this. Like, divide by zero some more. Like, I don't know.
Well, and to piggyback off of what you're saying, Sean, like Jared Leto, he wasn't the best Joker, no, but was he a good Joker?
Amazing.
Yes.
He's because...
trying to be a dick to the guy, but especially it was just funny. That's the guy you pick, because I'm like, nobody picks that guy.
He's great in Snyder Cut, man. Jared
Snyder Cut
so
was way
good.
Better.
Dude, just those 20 lines says enough, man.
But like,
the
thing about the Joker is like, you can't really break him down into one character, because he is the definition of insanity. So the way that I see it is like, there's not a bad Joker character. It's just a different take on him. Yeah. And who's to say who's right and who's wrong?
Schizophrenia.
Even in the comics,
you know,
he's random about his shit is. And well, that's his whole thing. You know? He is chaos.
Yeah, he's the jester. It's pretty sure, pretty sick.
Okay. I was putting together a podcast. My buddies all have little kids. Most of them do at least. And my buddy's daughter was in fifth grade when I started, because now I'm a year deep on this. So hopefully she made it to sixth grade. I should know. I don't know. I don't know.
Oh my God.
She's a good kid either way. Even if she doesn't make it to sixth grade, I still like that little kid. So she said, I need to ask every one of my guests when they first felt famous. So my question to each of you is, when did you guys first feel famous? The question's coming from a little kid. So if fame is not the road that you want to pursue in answering her question, when was there a kernel, a moment in your career that really changed you, made you feel good about what each of you are doing?
Okay.
It was a good moment. What would you guys each choose?
Man, there's so many. Like, I mean, when you're out here like this and you're just doing it, like I said, like my career, my dream job and my backup plan are all within 7 feet of the drum riser, you know, like not many people have all 3 feet, all three legs in the room, you know what I'm saying? So I'm right there. So there's been so many moments of like validation as a tech, validation as a player, validation as an engineer, I guess, like to bring it down to one, I would like to, I think quickly defining what fame is to me and then saying why. Fame to me is when it, and it's not good or bad, it's a neutral. It's a plasma, it's existence. It can haunt you or it can also make you. Some days you're like, oh, I'm famous, this feels amazing. Some days it's like, I just want to be away, you know? And when you live in a small town, people really believe social media, right? So they see you do a drum solo on the internet and they think that's how you play drums every single time. So you drop a stick, you feel like you're letting people down and you know, vibes like that. So I feel like the first time I felt that feeling that this is maybe the right angle was I was outside of a venue called Twist the Line with my band. And me and my friend Danny and Trey were just kind of standing outside. And this guy walks up and he was like, yo, bro, what's up, you guys? And we're like, hey, what's up, man? And immediately after greeting them, he just looks at me and he says, you're Sean Bentendoria, bro. You play drums in Traded Moments. And he was like, he gave me the full intro like you gave me. I've never met this guy before, you know, and I'm just thinking about how like I gotta go play drums in like a minute or two, you know. And yeah. and he proceeded to tell me about the sticking in the video I had just released and how he loved that I did a left hand patty fla-fla instead of a right-handed one. And I was like, yo, I didn't even realize I did any hybrid rudiments right there. Like I thought it was all flam tap. So just getting nerdy with that. The fact that he was on that level and like, you know, he was a drummer and I never met him before. I was just like, wow, this is like another level of introspection. So that put like the kernel, you know, and I think the moment when I felt it for real was sound checking King Crimson and a crowd chanting Sean, because the only way they would know my name is from the pamphlet.
That's neat.
Because we're all in the pamphlet, like who I teched for, what I did. So I came out because, you know, if you watch, you know, all King Crimson fans love it. They know what order they sound check in, what order you do stuff. I came out to like tune the kit and people were like, Sean, Sean. It was crazy, dude. It was insane. It was some hall in New York. One of the two we played. I'll check my tour laminate in a second. I don't remember exactly which one, but I you know, it was in New York City. I'm trying to think.
The Roseland? Like,
I don't know. I have to look at the laminate. It's just like, it's like a mult, you know, like,
did you say what's up to the audience or did you just ignore them? Like, don't talk.
Oh,
to
Oh no, no. I smiled and like, you know, it's.
Hunters be gone.
Well, you know, you gotta be that macabre. You gotta like, you know, they're asking for a set list and you don't hear them, you know, it's not my job. I was working under Jason Burney. So it's Jason's job to be like, piss off, buggers, no set list. You know, it's not my job. I'm just like smiling drummer guy with the floral shirt. So just hearing people I don't know chant my name for only tuning a kit. And honestly, Jeremy Stacy hates his kit tuned. So like, I'm already like not doing something I'm supposed to be doing. Like I'm like tuning his kit. But hearing, you know, that chant, it was really surreal. I was like, wow, like I'm just a drum tech. Like I figured King Crimson fans would give no shit about the techs, you know? So that was, the kernel was outside the venue playing locally. And then the stamp was that. I was like, wow, that's validation from two angles. Maybe,
yeah, awesome.
Maybe this is where I'm supposed to be. You know, this feels good. When I get money from this and I take care of my mom, like I take care of my mom in New Orleans. When I get revenue from music and it pays for something for my mom's necessities, it's a high I can't match with any drug.
Yeah, right.
There's no high like knowing the drums paid for something that Linda needs. There's nothing.
Did mom push you into doing the drums in the first place? Yeah,
my grandfather was a drummer. He was the percussion director at Loyola. He was a dean of percussion. He actually taught Ray Franson, Jonathan Sugarfoot Moffat from Michael Jackson. Johnny Vodakovich was one of his students. You know, and you know, through 6 degrees of separation, all these other famous New Orleans drummers, Russell Batiste. And I came up with, you know, no help. Neither one of my parents was in the scene. So I just chose drums. It was like one of those things in me. And I was the worst in high school. And then in college, it just like made sense. I ended up being an assistant drum captain. I quit that, started my own cover band, started managing bands. Just, I don't know. It's a thing. I've chased it ever since. So, and then my mom fell in health a little bit. And then it really changed the drive for me. I thought it would cripple me, but if anything, it completely empowered me. It put me in this impervious shield of armor. And I feel like nothing can really stop the drive. You know, I'll probably die first before I stop, you know? So that's what it feels like. But those two things, those two moments in fame, time, you know, multiverse, that's what probably solidifies my endless drive to do this, to do whatever this is, you know?
Yeah. I love it.
Thanks, man.
What do you got, Taylor?
I got a couple moments. I'd say, and fame is such a weird thing to like what Sean said, man, it's weird to kind of
define break that down
and have a definition.
You then tell the story. I think that's the best way. Like, what does fame mean to Taylor? And then how does it validate, you know?
Dude, I'm way too high to answer that question.
Honesty is good.
that was dank honesty. Dank.
Oh man. Okay, I'm gonna say two moments really. I would say one of the, and these kind of go in conjunction with one another. But hearing a song on 97.9 for the first time, and it wasn't like Sunday at midnight. Or, you know, like getting like a daytime decent slot. It was just like, holy shit. Like, we were just on the Real FM radio. And then.
Where were you the first time you heard?
I was driving in my car in Gulfport. And they played Closer. Scott Fox played Closer. And it was like 3 p.m. on a weekday, like close to the 5 o'clock, but like and this was many, many years ago. Like it was like, holy shit, like that's really cool. Like a lot of people just heard that, you know, and like it was just very surreal to me. And then next thing I know, my old band Catharsist had won this competition open for Avenged Sevenfold and Bullet for My Valentine and Treyu back in like 2008, like right when that entire thing was exploding. It was the Rockstar Taste of Chaos tour. And you know, none of those bands had ever come to the Gulf Coast before. So like everybody was there. Like nobody was trickling in. Like everybody was like, holy shit, this band's here. Like Facebook wasn't what it is now. MySpace was still the big thing. And like the world wasn't as connected, I guess. So it was like, holy, like we better get to see this band. And so we reaped the benefit of that. So like I'm 18 at the time and I'm stepping on stage in front of 10,000 people, but like I've never felt more comfortable in my entire fucking life. And you know, even though I wasn't the front man, like for some reason I always grabbed a mic and would talk to the audience. And being able to command a crowd of that magnitude and be successful at it, I was like, okay, this, first of all, it's weird that I'm comfortable too. Like they're not booing and like they're screaming back and they're having a good time. And I see people moshing. And right before we'd actually got on stage, I walked out with my, you know, my little digital camera and I heard my name like in the, and I was like, holy shit, someone just said my name from out in the crowd. So that was a pretty huge moment, I guess, of feeling kind of famous. And the last two, and getting picked up by Gibson Guitars earlier this year. That was big.
Yeah, that's awesome
for me. Conversations for that started 2 years ago with my buddy Heath Bathgate, who is at Gibson Guitars, and through working music retail when I wasn't on the road, I did a little stint at Sweetwater. I met Heath and we just became good friends, and I ended up doing a video for the 2019 Gibson collection for Sweetwater for their YouTube channel, and Heath really liked what I did. I showed him the music and we started a friendship, and he believed in what I was doing. And then I was able to seal the deal this year. And then right after that, you know, Sean and I played our first show together. And I'll say that was a moment for me too, because I had the best time slot I've ever had at CPR Fest. We played at, what was it, like 7:45 or something weird. It started out, it was sunset.
We went on at 7:25.
Yes. Beautiful.
Because I remember those three numbers specifically, like, yo, you're going on at 7:25. And I was just so ready. I had, my back was hurting. Oh, I just was so ready to play. It was crazy. It was crazy.
But you know, the guys Kenny and Scott at 97.9, like that to me was them putting belief in me as an artist, and through all the years of working together, saying, hey, you know what, you get to headline the second stage, you know, and it's a set that I've always wanted to personally play, because when I did Welcome to Rockville in 2013, I think it was, my favorite set from that entire weekend was Rob Zombie. And he started out sunset, and by the end of his set, like a twilight set, man. Like by the end of the set, it's nighttime. He had full use of the lights. It was a very cool transition. And for that to be a homecoming show for me, because I hadn't played my hometown in 4.5, 5 years at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So for them to bring me down from Detroit, me and James down, and then we grouped up with Sean, and for that to be, you know, the first show of this year with this band, and like, I don't know, it was just a really cool moment, because the entire day was beautiful. We sold a fuckload of merch. We did a partnership with To Write Love on Her Arms, and we did a guitar raffle giveaway, and we sold out of the Voodoo Dolls like that. Like the only way that we fucked that up is by not ordering more Voodoo Dolls. Like we could have raised probably triple the amount of money for that organization than we did, but it was a first test run that, you know, it went beautifully. But I don't know, it just felt like we were doing the thing and like signing autographs, and I remember I signed an autograph for this 14-year-old girl, I don't know how old she was, but I'm guessing 14, 15. And like, she freaked out and then ran away. And I was like, the fuck is that about? Like, you know, I didn't get it, but I was like, that was neat, but it's just me. Like, who cares? But like to them, like, it was like, holy shit. Like, I feel like I just looked to some teenager the way that, you know, Chester Bennington from Linkin Park looked to me when I was 14 going to see Linkin Park. Like, it was cool. It was just very cool to know that some kid was excited to meet me, and yeah, you know, maybe that sends them off a cool path with music. I don't know, but like that was just an interesting feeling that I've never gotten before.
Yeah.
So there's a couple moments, but it's hard to really put it down into one, because there's different stages of this game, you know, of being in a live band and whatnot, and different stages allot you different opportunities. So it's like, I feel like I felt that way in different points, but like, I don't think I'm famous at all though either. You know, like I've felt it, but I'm not.
Why'd you pick why pick Nine Inch Nails? Why'd you pick Every Day Is Exactly the Same?
I feel like blocks of my life, and what I mean by blocks, I mean years of my life have been that song. Like I, you know, and Sean, I'm sure dive into this too, but we're super big on mental health in this band. And we love our people hard, and we give grace to our people, but like, depression and doubt and anxiety, that's just been one of those things that I have always kind of suffered from, especially from a young age, because I got made fun of ruthlessly as a little kid. I don't know if you could see, but like my left eye is kind of fucked up. But like little kids are mean as shit. And like I quit summer camps when I was a kid, and you know, I was always the weird kid, and you know, and then
you became a rock star and slept with all their girlfriends.
Yeah, you know,
it was kind of crude, but
no. we're family oriented, man.
It's kind of mean, but yeah, all right.
I don't want someone to do that shit to me, man. Fuck that. But like, so like expanding upon that, and then with my ADHD and being a Ritalin baby and all this stuff, I live life in my head so much, and I send myself into overdrive. I send myself into fits of depression. I send myself into these deadlines that A, are unreasonable, and B, don't exist. Mm-hmm. And so that song was just comfort for me. Like, is like, there would be times where I would just be driving autopilot, staring dead, you know, at the road ahead of me. And I would listen to that song 60, 70 times in a day, but it was the only thing that brought me comfort in that moment. And, I don't know, it's just a song that means the world to me, and to really get to live in that song and live in Trent Reznor's head, who is one of my all-time favorite artists. Like, that dude's a fucking genius, man. Just absolute genius. But just to take a song that meant so much to me, and it's by an artist that means so much to me, like, it was almost a no-brainer.
Yeah.
So on top of that, that entire song is nothing but synthesizer. I mean, there's drum machines and stuff like that, but it's not a rock band. I'm sure Trent has, I wasn't there, I don't know what all they did, but it's more of an electronic song than it is a rock band kind of a song. So I basically,
so doing a song where you don't have to bring Sean out on the road with you, that's a winner.
It's like a reimagine. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, to rewrite the synth parts as guitar parts and put my own little spin in certain places, it was just really fun. And hopefully if he hears it, he approves. You know. But that was just it's a song that means a lot to me, and I love the fuck out of some Nine Inch Nails.
So what's next with Riding with Killers? What do you guys have on the plate?
Well,
did that one with Maxi was saying, right? It was that's the Biloxi, is that right?
Biloxi, that's some Fred Durst shit right there, man.
Biloxi,
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 Biloxi. I will be down in New Orleans in about 3 weeks with Sean. Sean introduced me to producer Jacob Herman, who owns Top Floor Studios in Gothenburg, Sweden.
Yeah, Jacob and is the man, dude. Big Jacob energy, yeah.
Dude, what I'm really excited about for that is the fact that, like, aside from, you know, working with bands like In Flames and Anthrax and Avatar, one of the recent releases he did, I am 100% in love with the whole record, but Vola. You know, James actually introduced me to Vola, and Sean is now introducing me to someone who is involved in the making of their, you know, debut record. That I say debut, but like, I think that's what their major label debut.
Yeah, it's their commercial push. This is the
right
one.
Right,
this
right.
is the one.
So
yeah.
So like, for, and then the fact that James and Sean and I ended up, you know, performing together and all this stuff started happening. Like, it's this weird, like, it's crazy how things come full circle. So, and that'll be the first song that Sean and I have done together with him jumping in Riding with Killers. So like, it's just, it's going to be really special. And on top of all of that, this will be the first time I've worked with a new producer in 10 years. I've been working with Matt LaPlante. Yeah, man. I'm excited. There's Matt also a little bit of nervousness because, like, Matt and I know each other, man. He's one of my best friends. The dude's family at this point, and I'm sure I'm going to continue. Like, we're always going to work together in some capacity. That's just the relationship that Matt and I have, and he knows how to get stuff out of me. He just does. But the fact that, like, there's now another avenue to you know, I don't know how Jacob's going to run me or how he's going to work me. So, like, to work with someone different after all this time is really exciting, but it's scary too, because, you know, you get in a comfortable spot and now I'm going to get out of my comfort zone. But I find that when you jump out of your comfort zone, that's where the most growth happens. And yeah, I feel like that's going to make a really beautiful song and a heavy just ass kicker of a tune.
I think that's the reason why the band being about, like, to touch back on mental health, like, 2 seconds, the mental health thing and being, you know, an outreach about that and being vocally spoken, like, so out loud about it, it really resonates down to, like, the way the music comes out. Like, Taylor has a different, you know, me and Taylor working together, him and Dave had an established energy, and now him meeting me, I basically love to disrupt. I am all about pushing people out of their comfort zone, because that's what I think resonates the deepest when you're looking for some kind of big change. If you're like, man, I'm stuck with drumming, I don't like how my drumming's coming along, then fuck something about your drumming up. Like, get uncomfortable, change the throne height, go drum somewhere you never drummed before, switch the kit to left-handed, like, make forced mistakes, because all those mistakes are just wisdom. Like, you know, wisdom is like, I fucked that up before, so I know how to not. That is roadie 101. Like, well, how do you know how to do pyro right? Because I've fucking done it really wrong before, you know? Like, so, you know, so, fuck. You know, so, it's
why
true.
You pick pyro? You know,
yeah, because there's no error in pyro, bro. Yeah. I have watched pyro mistakes, and no one's happy at the end of it. The guy that fucks up is not happy. I mean, you know, I'm not even in that band, and I'm like, what an asshole. Like, you know, everyone just shaming the guy that fucked up pyro. You know, anyway, aside from that, you know, I had a bunch of mutuals with Jakob. He did Camelot. He did a lot of stuff for Alex Landenberg. I believe that.
Oh, is it Jakob? Am I that culturally stupid?
I don't. What?
Oh, you can. I mean, dude, I said it.
You know, it doesn't matter.
Jakob, I'm sorry.
It doesn't matter. Moving on. It doesn't matter. Anyway, so look. So Jakob had been working with Alex Landenberg from Camelot for so long, and they did a drum pack together, and I checked for Alex on the last American Camelot tour. So I had been wanting to work with Jakob, and Jakob had been wanting to track me, and we've been talking about knowledge of drums, and he frequents New Orleans a lot. And one day I was like, you know, man, I would love to work with you. He was like, I would love to work with you too. He's like, you beat the fuck out of a kit, and you know so much about drums. And my buddy Kylie Roke, at the time, was doing my A&R stuff for PreSonus. And he put me in touch with them. And so then I was like, Taylor, this guy who's a legend, who we all like his music, whether you know it or not, he's coming to New Orleans. He's going to be doing a little bit of a studio abroad. And he's got incredible good time right now. And he wants to work with me. I was like, this is the perfect opportunity to rattle your system, break all your comforts, and come work with a producer that you've never worked with, while working with a drummer you've never worked with in a town you have yet to record in. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, you know, so it's like, come do this war with me, you know? It's like, what more could you ask for? You need raw drums for a record. You have a producer who wants to work with a drum tech who happens to also be drumming the record. So it's like, you know, I get to live
all lined up.
I'll be Jakob's drum tech, but I'll also be his, you know, his drumming subject, and I'll be Taylor's partner. But it's, you know, it's
multiple. Yeah, win-win.
Yeah, it's
do you have any tours lined up?
Not as of yet, man. There's a lot of background stuff that I'm working on. We have a music video that I'm starting to plan on getting a release for. I'm looking to shoot at least, hopefully, another 2 videos by the end of the summer. Get Sean up here.
You're gonna wear clothes in these ones? That'd be good.
What's that?
Or get Taylor down here.
You're gonna wear clothes in these videos?
What's that?
Are you gonna wear clothes in these videos this time?
Shirtless only.
Probably not.
Okay.
We're Seven Dust Ozfest energy. Shirtless only, dude.
So, right now, like mainly, it's it's about kind of building the brand up right now, playing some support slots here and there. Like I don't foresee us like truly touring. I mean, maybe something by the end of this year, but I would say shooting for 2023 is more realistic with all the things that I want to get done with getting the record finished and ready and having that product to really go out on the road and, you know, have all the right things, because instead of just jumping out there and trying to get stuff done along the way, the idea that I've had with this and what I've been doing for the last 3 years is essentially building a big ass shovel, or really a backhoe. So whenever it's time to really dig in, instead of making little small holes, I'm digging fucking craters and I'm making, you know, making movement here. Cause like when you really break it down, we've only had 3 live shows, Riding with Killers total. The first one, and this, you know, total different iteration of band at that point, but we did a live stream show during COVID for Shure Microphones. Last year we did 7 Dust and Tremonti, and then we just did CPR Fest with Seether, 3 Doors Down, Nonpoint, Bad Flower, Giovanni, and the Hired Guns, and Dead Poets Society, and our boys in Magnolia Bayou, Envision, Transient,
and Awaken the Giant played as well.
Awaken the Giant, you know, like for our third show to be headlining a second stage at a festival with those bands, like I'm trying to build it in that light to where it's like it's cold and calculated moves, but you know, like it might look like we're sitting still, but we're not.
Yeah.
But then whenever it's time to really jump out the gates and go, it's going to be time to jump out the gates and go. So, and it's basically just pick up good shows until we're truly ready. Yeah. And then once it's go time, it's go time. So, but I'm not putting any sort of crazy deadline or timeline on myself. Cause, all it's going to do is stress me the fuck out. And
we don't need that.
I got time for that shit.
No,
but you know, I know we've had a little bit of time since COVID kind of settled down or whatever, but it's still almost, you know, everything's still kind of bottlenecking. Like everyone's still playing catch up, trying to get through. And it's like to really try to break out as a band right now, it's almost like a fruitless effort. So I'd rather focus my attention on other areas. And then when it is like time,
a fruit roll up, it's just flat. See that? Wasn't that a great analogy? Pick up on that shit, Sean.
Dude, why'd you say that? Because I want a fruit roll up, no.
Good. That's good, though.
Yeah, that's good.
Well, gentlemen, I appreciate your time.
Oh,
yeah. That's a good time.
I thought it was just getting good.
Yeah. But I look forward to talking to you guys both again. I'll definitely be looking forward to listening to your new stuff. Want to watch this video? I hope that you still hire Sean, because God knows somebody needs to.
Yeah, he's stuck with me now. He already said he was in. I'm like, all right, you're fucked. So
all right. I'll talk to you guys both soon.
Later, man. Thanks for having us, bro.
Later.
It was a pleasure, man.
All right, you're on.
Yeah. So last story before pizza for me. And it's stuffed crust, better ingredients, better pizza, Pizza Hut. I'm pretty sure that's how it goes.
Papa John's, dude, what?
I'm being stupid. I was working for Morris Day and the Time up in Greenville, Mississippi at a casino. Yeah. And they're awesome, awesome people, man. Like I got to hang out with Tori and Jellybean and like all those guys. Super, super cool. Love those dudes. Well, the show's getting ready to start and like, you know, they're coming on with the intro and I'm over stage right. Tori's on stage left and his guitar's not coming on. And so I'm like, oh shit, I got to get the fuck over there, but I can't go backstage because they have all the equipment and everything. So I had to basically come around like this front area. Like they built like this pathway. Well, Morris is walking up at this point in time. And so, like, I'm panicked, and I'm trying to get to Tori, and Morris and these two big security guards are right there, and they see me, this little fucking weird white boy with tattoos running like, oh my God. And they like, they got right in front of Morris and they're like, the fuck is this guy about to do? And then I just,
Oh my God.
Like I veered past him and I ran all the way over to Tori's side and I jumped on the amp, but it turned out that he just didn't turn the volume knob up on his guitar. So I almost got my ass kicked by Morris Day's bodyguards for no reason. But it was still cool. And I still talk to Tori to this day. I fucking love that dude. He's wonderful.
Yeah, that's what was I gonna say? Oh, I had a quick one. I was trying to get drums out of this venue with Devil Driver. And I was like, hey man, close this red case. You can bring it to the truck. And man, I did the entire trailer. And right at the end, I was like, anybody see the red case go in? And everybody's like, no, I didn't see it. And I was like, this doesn't feel right. I mean, I did, and my drums go in first. And I'm at wall like six, you know, like it's a full trailer. So I'm like walking around and I can't confirm if red is in the trailer. Okay. But I also can't confirm if red is out of the trailer. So I'm like, if I leave, there's half a drum set just not in my tour pack. And like, I'm going to get fired. Like there's no other way about
gone.
It. You know? Yeah. Yeah. And it's going to cost them money. You know, it might cost half my made salary to get those drums back where they need to be on like whatever truck. And yeah, we close the trailer and everybody's mad at me because nobody knows what the fuck's going on. I'm like, why are we leaving? They're like, why are we leaving? I'm like, I don't know. I have this feeling that the drums aren't in there. It just doesn't feel right, you know? And I'm looking around and there's a pickup truck. It was Denver, Colorado. There's a pickup truck and there's a fucking red drum case parked next to it. And this guy comes up and says, hey man, I couldn't get it in the truck. And I was like, I'm not talking about the pickup truck. I'm talking about the 18 wheeler. That's why my band is now an hour late. It's a good thing I had that hunch in my stomach because I'm looking at Austin's drum case. You know, I they probably don't know that happened. I think it was just me and Brendan. But like other than that, you know, Billy might have not known. He might not wanted to absorb it. But yeah, that guy brought it to the truck, not to my 18 wheeler trailer. But I said truck because you know I do this. So
yeah.
I had this hunch, man. We started putting lights in, and I was like, those lights are fitting way too well, man. They didn't fit that good yesterday. Why do they fit so well? You know?
That's a great one.
Yeah, dude. So that's why I pack 18-wheelers, man. I just felt it. Just truck whisperer, you know?
Yeah, no, I get it.
Yeah.
I get it. That's okay. Wild. Those are good. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'll let you.
All right, boys. I'm going to go get some pizza now because I'm fucking hungry.
Thanks for watching. Don't forget to like and subscribe by clicking the round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or the guests on the show, go to joelrody.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle's Joel Rody. And don't forget, when you party like a rock star, don't be a dick.